a lumber yard. Like those back in the war camps. He started laughing.
Don't be so jovial, human, spat one of the overseers. You're to spend the next few weeks working here, building siege equipment. When the assault happens, you'll be at the front, running a ladder toward Kolinar's infamous walls.
Moash laughed even harder. It consumed him, shook him. He couldn't stop. He laughed helplessly until, short of breath, he dizzily lay back on the hard stone ground, tears leaking down the sides of his face.
"We have investigated this woman," Moraes' newest letter to Shallan read. "Ishna has overinflated her importance to you. She was indeed involved in espionage for House Hammaradin, as she told you, but she was merely an assistant to the true spies. We have determined that she is safe to allow close to you, though her loyalties should not be trusted too far. If you eliminate her, we will help cover up the disappearance, at your request. But we have no objection to you retaining her services." Shallan sighed, settling back in her seat, where she waited outside King Elokar's audience chamber. She'd found this paper unexpectedly in her satchel. So much for hoping Ishna had information about the ghost bloods she could use. The letter practically boiled with possessiveness. They would allow Ishna to be close to her? Storms, they acted like they owned her already. She shook her head, then rummaged in her satchel, taking out a small sphere pouch. It would look unremarkable to anyone inspecting it, for they wouldn't know that she'd transformed it with a small but simple illusion. Though it appeared violet, it was actually white. The interesting thing about it was not the illusion itself, but how she was powering it. She'd practiced before with attaching an illusion to pattern, or to a location, but she'd always needed to power it with her own stormlight. This one, however, she'd attached to a sphere inside the pouch. She was going on 4 hours now, with the light weaving needing no extra stormlight from her. She'd needed only to create it, then affix it to the sphere. Slowly, the light had been draining from the sapphire mark, just like a fabrial draining its gemstone. She'd even left the pouch alone in her rooms when going out, and the illusion had still been in place when she'd returned. This had begun as an experiment on how she could help Dalinar create his illusory maps of the world, then leave them for him without her having to remain in the meeting. Now, however, she was seeing all kinds of possible applications. The door opened, and she dropped the pouch back into her satchel. A master servant ushered a few merchants out of the king's presence. Then the servant bowed to Shallan, waving her in. She stepped hesitantly into the audience chamber, a room in Urethiru with a fine blue and green rug and stuffed with furniture. Diamonds shone from lamps, and Elokar had ordered the walls painted, obscuring the strata. The king himself, in a blue Kolin uniform, was unrolling a map onto a large table at the side of the room. "Was there another, Helt?" he asked the master servant. "I thought I was done for the—" He trailed off as he turned. "Brightness Shallan, were you waiting out there? You could have seen me immediately."
"I didn't want to be a bother," Shallan said, stepping over to him as the master servant prepared refreshment.
The map on the table showed Kolinar, a grand city, which seemed every bit as impressive as Vaidenar. Papers in a pile beside it looked to have the final reports from Spanreads in the city, and a wizened Ardent sat near them, ready to read for the king or take notes at his request. "I think we're almost ready," the king said, noting her interest. "The delay has been nearly insufferable, but requisite, I'm sure. Captain Kaladin did want to practice flying other people before bringing my royal person. I can respect that."
"He's asked me to fly with him above the storm to Thalen City," Shallan said, "to open the oath gate there. He's overly worried about dropping people, but if he does that to me, I'll have stormlight of my own and should survive the fall."
"Excellent," Elokar said.
Yes, a fine solution. But then you didn't come here to talk about this. What is your request of me?
Actually, Shallan said, could I talk to you in private for a moment, Your Majesty? He frowned, but then ordered his people to step out into the hallway. When two guards from Bridge 13 hesitated, the king was firm.
She's a knight radiant, he said. What do you think is going to happen to me?
They filed out, leaving the two of them beside Elokar's table. Shallan took a deep breath, then changed her face. Not to that of Vale or Radiant, not one of her secrets, but instead to an illusion of Adolin. It was still surprisingly uncomfortable for her to do it in front of someone. She'd still been telling most people that she was of the Elsecallers like Yasna, so they wouldn't know of her ability to become other people. Elokar jumped.
Ah, he said. Ah, that's right.
Your Majesty, Shallan said, changing her face and body to look like that of a cleaning woman she'd sketched earlier. I'm worried that your mission will not be as simple as you think. The letters out of Kolinar, the last ones they'd gotten, were frightened, worried things. They spoke of riots, of darkness, of Spren taking form and hurting people. Shallan changed her face to that of a soldier.
I've been preparing a team of spies, she explained, specializing in infiltration and information gathering. I've been keeping my focus quiet, for obvious reasons. I would like to offer my services for your mission.
I'm not certain, Elokar said hesitantly. If Dalinar would want me taking two of his radiants away from him.
I'm not accomplishing much for him sitting around here, Shallan said, still wearing the soldier's face. Besides, is it his mission, or is it yours?
My mission, the king said, then hesitated.
But let's not fool ourselves. If he didn't want you to go, I am not his subject, she said. Nor yours yet. I'm my own woman. You tell me. What happens if you get to Kolinar and the Oathgate is held by the enemy? Are you going to let the bridge man just fight his way in? Or might there be a better option? She changed her face to that of a Parsh woman she had from her older sketches.
Elokar nodded, walking around her.
A team, you say? Of spies? Interesting.
A short time later, Shallan left the room carrying, tucked into her safe pouch, a formal royal request to Dalinar for Shallan's aid on the mission. Kaladin had said he felt comfortable bringing six people, other than a few bridgemen, who could fly on their own. Adolin and Elokar would leave room for four others. She tucked Elokar's request into her safe pouch, beside the letter from Marais.
I just need to be away from this place, Shallan thought. I need to be away from them and from Yasna, at least until I can figure out what I want.
A part of her knew what she was doing. It was getting harder to hide things in the back of her mind and ignore them, now that she'd spoken ideals. Instead, she was fleeing. But she could help the group going to Kolinar. And it did feel exciting, the idea of going to the city and finding the secrets there. She wasn't only running. She'd also be helping Adolin reclaim his home. Pattern hummed from her skirts, and she hummed along with him.
52. After his father. 18 and a half years ago. Dalinar plodded back into camp so tired he suspected only the energy of his plate was keeping him upright. Each muggy breath inside his helm fogged the metal, which, as always, went somewhat transparent from the inside when you engaged the visor. He'd crushed the Hardassians, sending them back to start a civil war, securing the Alethi lands to the north and claiming the island of Akak. Now he'd moved southward to engage the Vaedans at the border. Herdaz had taken far longer than Dalinar had expected. He'd been out on campaign a total of 4 years now. 4 glorious years. Dalinar walked straight to his armorer's tent, picking up attendants and messengers along the way. When he'd ignored their questions, they trailed after him like kremlings eyeing a great shell's kill, waiting for their moment to snatch a tidbit. Inside the tent, he extended his arms to the sides and let the armorers start the disassembly. Helm, then arms, revealing the gambeson he wore for padding. The helm's removal exposed sweaty, clammy skin that made the air feel too cold. The breastplate was cracked along the left side, and the armorers buzzed, discussing the repair. As if they had to do something other than merely give the plate stormlight and let it regrow itself. Eventually, all that remained were his boots, which he stepped out of, maintaining a martial posture by pure force of will. Without the support of his plate, exhaustion spren began to shoot up around him like jets of dust. He stepped over to a set of travel cushions and sat down, reclining against them, sighing and closing his eyes.
"Bright Lord," one of the armorers asked, "that's where we sit." "This is now my audience tent," Dalinar said, not opening his eyes. "Take what is absolutely essential and leave me."
The clanking of armor stopped as the workers digested what he'd said. They left in a whispering rush, and nobody else bothered him for a blissful 5 minutes, until footfalls sounded nearby. Tent flaps rustled, then leather scrunched as someone knelt beside him.
"The final battle report is here, Bright Lord," Kadash's voice.
Of course it would be one of his storming officers. Dalinar had trained them far too well.
"Speak,"
Dalinar said, opening his eyes. Kadash had reached middle age, maybe 2 or 3 years older than Dalinar. He now had a twisting scar across his face and head from where a spear had hit him.
"We completely routed them, Bright Lord," Kadash said. "Our archers and light infantry followed with an extended harry. We slew, by best count, 2,000. Nearly half. We could have gotten more if we'd boxed them into the south."
"Never box in an enemy, Kadash," Dalinar said. "You want them to be able to retreat, or they'll fight you worse for it. A rout will serve us better than an extermination. How many people did we lose?"
"Barely 200.
Dalinar nodded. Minimal losses, while delivering a devastating blow.
"Sir," Kadash said, "I'd say this raiding group is done for.
We've still got many more to dig out. This will last years yet.
Unless the Vaden send in an entire army and engage us in force."
"They won't," Dalinar said, rubbing his forehead. "Their king is too shrewd. It isn't full-on war he wants. He only wanted to see if any contested land had suddenly become uncontested."
"Yes, Bright Lord."
"Thank you for the report. Now get out of here, and post some storming guards at the front so I can rest. Don't let anyone in, not even the Night Watcher herself."
"Yes, sir."
Kadash crossed the tent to the flaps.
Sir, you were incredible out there. Like a tempest."
Dalinar just closed his eyes and leaned back, fully determined to fall asleep in his clothing. Sleep, unfortunately, refused to come. The report set his mind to considering implications. His army had only one soulcaster for emergencies, which meant supply trains. These borderlands were expansive, hilly, and the Vadens had better generals than the Herdazians. Defeating a mobile enemy was going to be hard in such circumstances, as this first battle proved. It would take planning, maneuvering, and skirmish after skirmish to pin the various groups of Vadens down and bring them into proper battle. He yearned for those early days when their fights had been more rowdy, less coordinated. Well, he wasn't a youth anymore, and he'd learned in Herdaz that he no longer had Gavilar to do the hard parts of this job. Dalinar had camps to supply, men to feed, and logistics to work out. This was almost as bad as being back in the city, listening to scribes talk about sewage disposal. Save for one difference. Out here, he had a reward. At the end of all the planning, the strategy, and the debates with generals, came the thrill. In fact, through his exhaustion, he was surprised to find that he could sense it still. Deep down, like the warmth of a rock that had known a recent fire. He was glad that the fighting had dragged on all these years. He was glad that the Herdazians had tried to seize that land, and that now the Vedans wanted to test him. He was glad that other high princes weren't sending aid, but waiting to see what he could accomplish on his own. Most of all, he was glad that, despite today's important battle, the conflict was not over. Storms, he loved this feeling. Today hundreds had tried to bring him down, and he'd left them ashen and broken. Outside his tent, people demanding his attention were turned away one after another. He tried not to feel pleasure each time. He would answer their questions eventually, just not now. Thoughts finally released their grip on his brain, and he dipped toward slumber, until one unexpected voice jerked him out of it and sent him bolting upright. That was Evie. He leapt to his feet. The thrill surged again within him, drawn out of its own slumber. Dalinar ripped open the tent's front flaps and gaped at the blonde-haired woman standing outside, wearing a Vorin haba, but with sturdy walking boots sticking out below. Evie said. Husband. She looked him up and down, and her expression soured, lips puckering. Has no person seen fit to order him a bath? Where are his grooms to see him undressed properly?
Why are you here? Dalinar demanded.
He hadn't intended to roar it, but he was so tired, so shocked. Evie leaned backward before the outburst, eyes opening wide. He briefly felt a spike of shame. But why should he? This was his war camp. Here he was the Blackthorn. This was the place where his domestic life should have no purchase on him. By coming here, she invaded that. Evie said.
Other women are at the camp. Other wives. It is common for women to go to war.
Alethi women, Dalinar snapped, trained to it from childhood and acquainted with the ways of warfare. We spoke of this, Evie.
He halted, looking at the guards. They shuffled uncomfortably.
Come inside, Evie, Dalinar said. Let's discuss this in private.
Very well. And the children?
You brought our children to the battlefront?
Storms, she didn't even have the sense to leave them at the town the army was using as a long-term command post.
In, Dalinar said, pointing at the tent.
Evie wilted, then scuttled to obey, cringing as she passed him. Why had she come? Hadn't he just been back to Kolinar to visit?
That had been recent, he was sure.
Or maybe not so recent. He did have several letters from Evie that Teleb's wife had read to him, with several more waiting to be read. He dropped the flaps back into position and turned toward Evie, determined not to let his frayed patience rule him.
Navani said I should come, Evie said. She said it was shameful that you have waited so long between visits. Adolin has gone over a year without seeing you, Dalinar. And little Renarin has never even met his father.
Renarin,
Dalinar said, trying to work out the name. He hadn't picked that.
Evie said, from my language. Nar, after his father. In, to be born unto.
Stormfather, that was a butchering of the language.
Dalinar fumbled, trying to work through it. Nar meant like unto.
What does re mean in your language?
Dalinar asked, scratching his face.
It has no meaning, Evie said. It is simply the name. It means our son's name, or him.
Dalinar groaned softly. So the child's name was like one who was born unto himself.
Delightful. You didn't answer, Evie pointed out, when I asked after a name via Spanreed.
How had Navani and Iole allowed this travesty of a name?
Storms. Knowing those two, they'd probably encouraged it.
They were always trying to get Evie to be more forceful. He moved to get something to drink, but then remembered that this wasn't actually his tent. There wasn't anything in here to drink but armor oil.
"You shouldn't have come," Dalinar said. "It is dangerous out here."
"I wish to be a more Alethi wife. I want you to want me to be with you."
He winced.
"Well, you should still not have brought the children."
Dalinar slumped down into the cushions.
"They are heirs to the princedom, assuming this plan of Gavilar's with the crown lands and his own throne works out. They need to remain safe in Kolinar."
"I thought you'd want to see them,"
Ebi said, stepping up to him. Despite his harsh words, she unbuckled the top of his gambeson to get her hands under it and begin rubbing his shoulders. It felt wonderful. He let his anger melt away. It would be good to have a wife with him, to scribe, as was proper. He just wished that he didn't feel so guilty at seeing her. He was not the man she wanted him to be.
"I hear you had a great victory today,"
Ebi said softly.
"You do service to the king."
"You'd have hated it, Ebi. I killed hundreds of people. If you stay, you'll have to listen to war reports, accounts of deaths, many at my hand."
She was silent for a time.
"Could you not let them surrender to you?"
"The Vaidens aren't here to surrender. They're here to test us on the battlefield."
"And the individual men? Do they care for such reasoning as they die?"
"What? Would you like me to stop and ask each man to surrender as I prepare to strike him down?"
"Would that—"
"No, Ebi, that wouldn't work."
"Oh."
He stood up, suddenly anxious.
"Let's see the boys, then."
Leaving his tent and crossing the camp was a slog, his feet feeling like they'd been encased in blocks of creme. He didn't dare slouch. He always tried to present a strong image for the men and women of the army, but he couldn't help that his padded garb was wrinkled and stained with sweat. The land here was lush compared to Kolinar. The thick grass was broken by sturdy stands of trees, and tangled vines draped the western cliff faces. There were places farther into Yarkoved where you couldn't take a step without vines writhing under your feet. The boys were by Evie's wagons. Little Adolin was terrorizing one of the chulls, perched atop its shell and swinging a wooden sword about, showing off for several of the guards, who dutifully complimented his moves. He'd somehow assembled armor from strings and bits of broken rockbud shell.
"Storms he's grown," Dalinar thought.
When last he'd seen Adolin, the child had still looked like a toddler, stumbling through his words. Little over a year later, the boy spoke clearly and dramatically as he described his fallen enemies. They were apparently evil flying chulls. He stopped when he saw Dalinar, then he glanced at Evie. She nodded and the child scrambled down from the chull. Dalinar was certain he'd fall at three different points. He got down safely, walked over, and saluted. Evie beamed.
"He asked the best way to talk to you," she whispered. "I told him you were a general, the leader of all the soldiers. He came up with that on his own."
Dalinar squatted down. Little Adolin immediately shied back, reaching for his mother's skirts.
"Afraid of me?" Dalinar asked. "Not unwise. I'm a dangerous man."
"Daddy,"
the boy said, holding to the skirt with one white-knuckled hand, but not hiding.
"Yes. Don't you remember me?"
Hesitantly, the motley-haired boy nodded.
"I remember you. We talk about you every night when we burn prayers. So you will be safe, fighting bad men."
"I'd prefer to be safe from the good ones, too," Dalinar said. "Though I will take what I am offered."
He stood up, feeling... what? Shame to not have seen the boy as often as he should have? Pride at how the boy was growing? The thrill still squirming deep down. How had it not dissipated since the battle?
"Where is your brother, Adolin?"
Dalinar asked. The boy pointed toward a nurse who carried a little one. Dalinar had expected a baby, but this child could nearly walk, as evidenced by the nurse putting him down and watching fondly as he toddled a few steps, then sat, trying to grab blades of grass as they pulled away. The child made no sounds. He just stared, solemn, as he tried to grip blade after blade. Dalinar waited for the excitement he'd felt before upon meeting Adolin for the first time. But storms. He was just so tired.
"Can I see your sword?" Adolin asked.
Dalinar wanted nothing more than to sleep, but he summoned the blade anyway, driving it into the ground with the edge pointed away from Adolin. The boy's eyes grew wide.
"Mommy says I can't have my plate yet," Adolin said.
"Teleb needs it. You can have it when you come of age."
"Good. I'll need it to win a blade."
Nearby, Evie clicked her tongue softly, shaking her head. Dalinar smiled, kneeling beside his blade and resting his hand on the boy's shoulder.
"I'll win you one in war, son."
"No,"
Adolin said, chin up.
"I want to win my own, like you did."
"A worthy goal," Dalinar said. "But a soldier needs to be willing to accept help. You mustn't be hard-headed. Pride doesn't win battles."
The boy cocked his head, frowning.
"Your head isn't hard?"
He rapped his knuckles against his own. Dalinar smiled, then stood up and dismissed Oathbringer. The last embers of the thrill finally faded.
"It's been a long day," he told Evie. "I need to rest. We'll discuss your role here later."
Evie led him to a bed within one of her storm wagons. Then, at last, Dalinar was able to sleep.
Alethi Glyphs, page 1. "My friend, the secrets uncovered infiltrating the Calligrapher's Guild are more mundane than expected. I prefer bloodstains to inkstains any day, so next time send me somewhere I'm more likely to die from wounds than from hand cramps. By purities, if you ask me to draw another glyph..." "The darkest secret of the Guild is that the phonemes within a glyph can sometimes be deciphered. Sorry to shatter your theories of dark rites and ancient moon dances, but glyphs aren't pronounced or read. They're memorized, and they change over time till the original collection of phonograms is almost unrecognizable. Take, for instance, the glyph for storm. Zerus. High, Ketcha. High storm, Kazerus. Eternal, Kalad. Everstorm, Kalazeris. Contrast Zerus with a glyph in its infancy, Zataleth, a bat-like cephalopod the Alethi hadn't encountered until their recent conquests in Akak. The glyph's phonemes are apparent as well as the glyph's resemblance to the actual creature. Glyphs have simplified versions for small writing. Glyph pairs are slightly more common than single glyphs. Less used are three glyphs in a row. Even older than Zerus are the glyphs used in the first oath of the Knights Radiant. Yavani Tebel Tzameth, Katav Tebel Kadilak, Melak Tebel Maviz. These resemble more the complex, unreadable glyphs representing the orders of knights than they do any middle or modern Alethi glyphs. I suspect these were borrowed from an earlier source and incorporated into an already developing Alethi glyph lexicon. This supports the claim that Alethi glyphs were adopted from older scripts likely descended from Dawn Chant, and might explain the two sets of phonemes used in glyph creation, standard and calligraphic. Glyph makers use both, the phonemes rotated, flipped, and distorted, to fit the calligrapher's vision. Next page, the calligraphic phoneme set.
53. Such a twisted cut. "Friend, your letter is most intriguing," even revelatory. The ancient Siln dynasty in Yakeved had been founded after the death of King Nanchet. No contemporary accounts survived. The best they had dated from 2 centuries later. The author of that text, Natata Ved, often called Oil Eyes by her contemporaries, insisted that her methods were rigorous, although by modern standards, historical scholarship had been in its infancy. Yasna had long been interested in Nanchet's death because he'd ruled for only 3 months. He'd succeeded to the throne when the previous king, his brother Nanhar, had taken ill and died while on campaign in what would become modern Triax. Remarkably, during the brief span of his reign, Nanchet survived 6 assassination attempts. The first had come from his sister, who had wanted to place her husband on the throne. After surviving poisoning, Nanchet had put them both to death. Soon after, their son had tried to kill him in his bed. Nanchet, apparently a light sleeper, struck down his nephew with his own sword. Nanchet's cousin tried next. That attack left Nanchet blinded in one eye, and was followed by another brother, an uncle, and finally Nanchet's own son. At the end of 3 exasperating months, according to Oil Eyes, the great but weary Nanchet called for an accounting of all his household. He gathered them together at a grand feast, promising the delights of distant Eomia. Instead, when all were assembled, Nanchet had them executed one by one. Their bodies were burned in a grand pyre, upon which was cooked the meat for the feast that he ate alone at a table set for 200. Natata Oil Eyes was known to have had a passion for the dramatic. The text sounded almost delighted when she'd explained how he died by choking on the food at that very feast, alone, with nobody to help him. Similar tales repeated themselves throughout the long history of the Vorin lands. Kings fell, and their brothers or sons took the throne. Even a pretender of no true lineage would usually claim kinship through oblique and creative genealogical justifications. Yasna was simultaneously fascinated and worried by these accounts. Thoughts about them were unusually present in her mind as she made her way into Urethiru's basement. Something in her readings the night before had lodged this particular story in her brain. She soon peeked into the former library beneath Urethiru. Both rooms, one on either side of the hallway that led to the crystal pillar, were filled with scholars now, occupying tables carried down by squads of soldiers. Dalinar had sent expeditions down the tunnel the Unmade had used to flee. The scouts reported a long network of caverns. Following a stream of water, they'd marched for days, and eventually located an exit into the mountain foothills of Tufalia. It was nice to know that, in a pinch, there was another way out of Urethiru, and a potential means of supply, other than through the Oath Gates. They maintained guards in the upper tunnels, and for now it seemed safe enough in the basement. Therefore, Navani had transformed the area into a scholarly institute designed to solve Dalinar's problems and to provide an edge in information, technology, and pure research. Concentration spren rippled in the air like waves overhead, a rarity in Alethkar, but common here, and logic spren darted through them like tiny storm clouds. Yasna couldn't help but smile. For over a decade she'd dreamed of uniting the best minds of the kingdom in a coordinated effort. She'd been ignored. All anyone had wanted to discuss was her lack of belief in their god. Well, they were focused now. Turned out that the end of the world had to actually arrive before people would take it seriously. Renarin was there, standing near the corner, watching the work. He'd been joining the scholars with some regularity, but he still wore his uniform with the Bridge 4 patch. "You can't spend forever floating between worlds, cousin," she thought. "Eventually you'll need to decide where you want to belong." Life was so much harder but potentially so much more fulfilling, when you found the courage to choose. The story of the old Vedan king, Nanhet, had taught Yasna something troubling. Often, the greatest threat to a ruling family was its own members. Why were so many of the old royal lines such knots of murder, greed, and infighting? And what made the few unique exceptions different? She'd grown adept at protecting her family against danger from without, carefully removing would-be deposers. But what could she do to protect it from within? In her absence already, the monarchy trembled. Her brother and her uncle, who she knew loved each other deeply, ground their wills against one another like mismatched gears. She would not have her family implode. If Alethkar was going to survive the desolation, they'd need committed leadership, a stable throne. She entered the library room and walked to her writing stand. It was in a position where she could survey the others and have her back to a wall. She unpacked her satchel, setting up two span reed boards. One of the reeds was blinking early, and she twisted the ruby, indicating she was ready. A message came back, writing out, "We will begin in 5 minutes." She passed the time scrutinizing the various groups in the room, reading the lips of those she could see, absently taking notes in shorthand. She moved from conversation to conversation, gleaning a little from each one, and noting the names of the people who spoke. "Tests confirm something is different here. Temperatures are distinctly lower on other nearby peaks of the same elevation. We have to assume that Bright Lord Colin is not going to return to the Faith. What then?"
"Don't know. Perhaps if we could find a way to conjoin the Fabrials, we could imitate this effect."
"The boy could be a powerful addition to our ranks. He shows interest in numerology, and asked me if we can truly predict events with it. I will speak with him again."
That last one was from the Storm Wardens. Yasna tightly pursed her lips.
"Ivory," she whispered, "I will watch them."
He left her side, shrunken to the size of a speck of dust. Yasna made a note to speak to Renarin. She would not have him wasting his time with a bunch of fools who thought they could foretell the future based on the curls of smoke from a snuffed candle. Finally, her span reed woke up. "I have connected Jochi of Thelena and Ethid of Aesir for you, Brightness. Here are their passcodes. Further entries will be strictly their notations."
"Excellent," Yasna wrote back, authenticating the two passcodes.
Losing her span reeds in the sinking of the wind's pleasure had been a huge setback. She could no longer directly contact important colleagues or informants. Fortunately, Tashik was set up to deal with these kinds of situations. You could always buy new reeds connected to the princedom's infamous information centers. You could reach anyone in practice, so long as you trusted an intermediary. Yasna had one of those she'd personally interviewed, and whom she paid good money to ensure confidentiality. The intermediary would burn her copies of this conversation afterward. The system was as secure as Yasna could make it, all things considered. Yasna's intermediary would now be joined by two others in Tashik. Together the three would be surrounded by 6 span reed boards, one each for receiving comments from their masters, and one each to send back the entire conversation in real time, including the comments from the other two. That way, each conversant would be able to see a constant stream of comments without having to stop and wait before replying. Navani talked of ways to improve the experience, of span reads that could be adjusted to connect to different people. That was one area of scholarship, however, that Yasna did not have time to pursue. Her receiving board started to fill with notes written by her two colleagues.
"Yasna, you live," Jochi wrote. "Back from the dead. Remarkable."
"I can't believe you ever thought she was dead," Ethid replied.
"Yasna Colin? Lost at sea? Liklier we'd find the Stormfather dead."
"Your confidence is comforting, Ethid,"
Yasna wrote on her sending board. A moment later, those words were copied by her scribe into the common spanreed conversation. "Are you at Irithiru?" Jochi wrote. "When can I visit?" "As soon as you're willing to let everyone know you aren't female," Yasna wrote back. Jochi, known to the world as a dynamic woman of distinctive philosophy, was a pen name for a pot-bellied man in his 60s who ran a pastry shop in Thalen City. "Oh, I'm certain your wonderful city has need of pastries," Jochi wrote back jovially. "Can we please discuss your silliness later?" Ethid wrote. "I have news." She was a scion, a kind of religious order of scribe, at the Azish Royal Palace. "Well, stop wasting time, then," Jochi wrote. "I love news. Goes excellently with a filled donut. No, a fluffy brioche." "The news?" Yasna just wrote, smiling. These two had studied with her under the same master. They were Veristatalians of the keenest mind, regardless of how Jochi might seem. "I've been tracking a man we are increasingly certain is the Herald Naku, the judge," Ethid wrote. "Nalan, as you call him."
"Oh, are we sharing nursery tales now?" Jochi asked. "Heralds? Really, Ethid?"
"If you haven't noticed," Ethid wrote, "the Voidbringers are back. Tales we dismissed are worth a second look now."
"I agree," Yasna wrote. "But what makes you think you found one of the Heralds?"
"It's a combination of many things," she wrote. "This man attacked our palace, Yasna. He tried to kill some thieves. The new Prime is one of them, but keep that in your sleeve. We're doing what we can to play up his common roots while ignoring the fact that he was intent on robbing us."
"Harold's alive and trying to kill people," Jochi wrote. "And here I thought my news about a sighting of Axes the Collector was interesting."
"There's more," Ethid wrote. "Yasna, we've got a Radiant here. An Edge Dancer, or we had one."
"Had one?" Jochi wrote. "Did you misplace her?"
"She ran off. She's just a kid, Yasna. Reshi, raised on the streets."
"I think we may have met her," Yasna wrote. "My uncle encountered someone interesting in one of his recent visions. I'm surprised you let her get away from you."
"Have you ever tried to hold on to an Edge Dancer?" Ethid wrote back. "She chased after the Herald to Tashik, but the Prime says she is back now and avoiding me. In any case, something's wrong with the man I think is Nalan, Yasna. I don't think the Heralds will be a resource to us."
"I will provide you with sketches of the Heralds," Yasna said. "I have drawings of their true faces provided by an unexpected source. Ethid, you are right about them. They aren't going to be a resource. They're broken. Have you read the accounts of my uncle's visions?"
"I have copies somewhere," Ethid wrote. "Are they real? Most sources agree that he's unwell."
"He's quite well, I assure you," Yasna wrote. "The visions are related to his Order of Radiance. I will send you the latest few. They have relevance to the Heralds."
"Storms," Ethid wrote. "The Blackthorn is actually a Radiant? Years of drought, and now they're popping up like rock buds." Ethid did not think highly of men who earned their reputations through conquest, despite having made the study of such men a cornerstone of her research. The conversation continued for some time. Jochi, growing uncharacteristically solemn, spoke directly of the state of Thalena. It had been hit hard by the repeated coming of the Everstorm. Entire sections of Thalen City were in ruin. Yasna was most interested in the Thalen Parshmen who had stolen the ships that had survived the storm. Their exodus, combined with Kaladin Stormblessed's interactions with the Parshmen in Alethkar, was painting a new picture of what and who the Voidbringers were. The conversation moved on as Ethid transcribed an interesting account she'd discovered in an old book discussing the desolations. From there, they spoke of the dawn chant translations, in particular some ardents in Yakaved who were ahead of the scholars at Karbranth. Yasna glanced through the library room, seeking out her mother, who was sitting near Shallan to discuss wedding preparations. Renarin still lurked at the far side of the room, mumbling to himself. Or perhaps to his spren? She absently read his lips.
"It's coming from in here," Renarin said. "Somewhere in this room."
Yasna narrowed her eyes. "Ethid," she wrote, "weren't you going to try to construct drawings of the spren tied to each order of radiant?"
"I've gotten quite far, actually," she wrote back. "I saw the Edge Dancer spren personally after demanding a glimpse."
"What of the Truth Watchers?" Yasna wrote.
"Oh, I found a reference to those," Jochi wrote. "The spren reportedly looked like light on a surface after it reflects through something crystalline."
Yasna thought for a moment, then briefly excused herself from the conversation. Jochi said he needed to go find a privy anyway. She slipped off her seat and crossed the room, passing near Navani and Shallan.
"I don't want to push you at all, dear," Navani was saying. "But in these uncertain times, surely you wish for stability?"
Yasna stopped, free hand resting idly on Shallan's shoulder. The younger woman perked up, then followed Yasna's gaze toward Renarin.
"What?" Shallan whispered.
"I don't know," Yasna said. "Something odd."
Something about the way the youth was standing, the words he had spoken. He still looked wrong to her without his spectacles, like a different person entirely.
"Yasna," Shallan said, suddenly tense.
"The doorway, look." Yasna sucked in stormlight at the girl's tone and turned away from Renarin toward the room's doorway. There, a tall, square-jawed man had darkened the opening. He wore Sadeus's colors, forest green and white. In fact, he was Sadeus now. At least, its regent. Yasna would always know him as Meridas Amaram.
"What's he doing here?" Shallan hissed.
"He's a high prince," Navani said. "The soldiers aren't going to forbid him without a direct command."
Amaram fixated on Yasna with regal, light tan eyes. He strode toward her, exuding confidence. Or was it conceit?
"Yasna," he said when he drew close. "I was told I could find you here."
"Remind me to find whoever told you," Yasna said, "and have them hanged."
Amaram stiffened.
"Could we speak together more privately, just for a moment?"
"I think not."
"We need to discuss your uncle. The rift between our houses serves nobody. I wish to bridge that chasm, and Dalinar listens to you. Please, Yasna, you can steer him properly."
"My uncle knows his own mind on these matters and doesn't require me to steer him."
"As if you haven't been doing so already, Yasna. Everyone can see that he has started to share your religious beliefs."
"Which would be incredible since I don't have religious beliefs."
Amaram sighed, looking around.
"Please," he said. "Private?"
"Not a chance, Meridas."
"Go away. We were close once."
"My father wished us to be close. Do not mistake his fancies for fact."
"Yasna,
you really should leave before somebody gets hurt."
He ignored her suggestion, glancing at Navani and Shallan, then stepping closer.
"We thought you were dead. I needed to see for myself that you are well."
"You have seen. Now leave."
Instead, he gripped her forearm.
"Why, Yasna? Why have you always denied me?"
"Other than the fact that you are a detestable buffoon who achieves only the lowest level of mediocrity, as it is the best your limited mind can imagine, I can't possibly think of a reason."
"Mediocre?"
Amaram growled. You insult my mother, Yasna. You know how hard she worked to raise me to be the best soldier this kingdom has ever known.
Yes. From what I understand, she spent the 7 months she was with child entertaining each and every military man she could find in the hopes that something of them would stick to you.
Meridas's eyes widened, and his face flushed deeply. To their side, Shallan audibly gasped.
You godless whore!
Amaram hissed, releasing her.
If you weren't a woman, if I weren't a woman, I suspect we wouldn't be having this conversation. Unless I were a pig. Then you'd be doubly interested.
He thrust his hand to the side, stepping back, preparing to summon his blade. Yasna smiled, holding her free hand toward him, letting stormlight curl and rise from it. Oh, please do, Meridas. Give me an excuse, I dare you.
He stared at her hand. The entire room had gone silent, of course. He'd forced her to make a spectacle. His eyes flicked up to meet hers. Then he spun and stalked from the room, shoulders hunched as if trying to shrug away the eyes and the snickers of the scholars.
He will be trouble, Yasna thought, even more than he has been. Amaram genuinely thought he was Alethkar's only hope and salvation, and had a keen desire to prove it. Left alone, he'd rip the armies apart to justify his inflated opinion of himself. She'd speak with Dalinar. Perhaps the two of them could devise something to keep Amaram safely occupied. And if that didn't work, she wouldn't speak to Dalinar about the other precautions she would take. She'd been out of touch for a long time, but she was confident there would be assassins for hire here, ones who knew her reputation for discretion and excellent pay. A high-pitched sound came from beside her, and Yasna glanced to find Shallan sitting perkily on her seat, making an excited noise in the back of her throat and clapping her hands together quickly, the sound muffled by her clothed safe hand.
Wonderful. Mother, Yasna said, might I speak for a moment with my ward?
Navani nodded, her eyes lingering on the doorway where Amaram had exited. Once she'd pushed for the union between them. Yasna didn't blame her. The truth of Amaram was difficult to see, and had been even more so in the past, when he'd been close to Yasna's father. Navani withdrew, leaving Shallan alone at the table stacked with reports.
Brightness, Shallan said as Yasna sat. That was incredible!
I let myself be pushed into abundant emotion.
You were so clever!
And yet my first insult was not to attack him, but the moral reputation of his female relative. Clever? Or simply the use of an obvious bludgeon?
Well,
regardless, Yasna cut in, wishing to avoid further conversation about Amaram. I've been thinking about your training.
Shallan stiffened immediately.
I've been very busy, Brightness. However, I'm sure I'll be able to get to those books you assigned me very soon.
Yasna rubbed her forehead.
This girl.
Brightness, Shallan said. I think I might have to request a leave from my studies.
Shallan spoke so quickly, the words ran into one another.
His Majesty says he needs me to go with him on the expedition to Kolinar.
Yasna frowned.
Kolinar?
Nonsense. They'll have the Windrunner with them.
Why do they need you?
The king is worried they might need to sneak into the city, Shallan said. Or even through the middle of it, if it's occupied. We can't know how far the siege has progressed. If Elokar has to reach the Oath Gate without being recognized, then my illusions will be invaluable. I have to go. It's so inconvenient. I'm sorry.
She took a deep breath, eyes wide, as if afraid that Yasna would snap at her.
This girl.
I'll speak with Elokar, Yasna said. I feel that might be extreme. For now, I want you to do drawings of Renarin's and Kaladin's spren. For scholarly reasons.
Bring them to me for... She trailed off. What is he doing?
Renarin stood near the far wall, which was covered in palm-sized tiles. He tapped a specific one and somehow made it pop out, like a drawer.
Yasna stood, throwing back her chair. She strode across the room, Shallan scampering along behind her.
Renarin glanced at them, then held up what he'd found in the small drawer. A ruby, long as Yasna's thumb, cut into a strange shape with holes drilled in it.
What on Roshar?
She took it from him and held it up.
What is it? Navani said, shouldering up beside her. A fabrial?
No metal parts. What is that shape?
Yasna reluctantly surrendered it to her mother. So many imperfections in the cut, Navani said. That will cause it to lose stormlight quickly. It won't even hold a charge for a day, I bet. And it will vibrate something fierce.
Curious.
Yasna touched it, infusing the gemstone with stormlight. It started glowing, but not nearly as brightly as it should have. Navani was, of course, right. It vibrated as stormlight curled off it. Why would anyone spoil a gem with such a twisted cut? And why hide it? The small drawer was latched with a spring, but she couldn't see how Renarin had gotten it undone.
Storms, Shallan whispered as other scholars crowded around. That's a pattern.
A pattern?
Buzzes in sequence, Shallan said. My friend says he thinks this is a code. Letters?
Music of language, Renarin whispered. He drew in stormlight from some spheres in his pocket, then turned and pressed his hands against the wall, sending a surge of stormlight through it that extended from his palms like twin ripples on the surface of a pond. Drawers slid open, one behind each white tile. 100, 200, each revealing gemstones inside. The library had decayed, but the ancient radiance had obviously anticipated that. They'd found another way to pass on their knowledge.
54. An Ancient Singer's Name. I would have thought, before attaining my current station, that a deity could not be surprised. Obviously, that is not true. I can be surprised. I can perhaps even be naive, I think. I'm just asking, Ken grumbled. How is this any better? We were slaves under the Alethi. Now we're slaves under the Fused. Great! It does me so much good to know that our misery is now at the hands of our own people. The Parsh woman set her bundle down with a rattling thump. You'll get us in trouble again talking like that, Saw said. He dropped his bundle of wooden poles, then walked back the other way. Moash followed, passing rows of humans and Parshmen turning the poles into ladders. These, like Saw and the rest of his team, would soon be carrying those ladders into battle, facing down a storm of arrows. What a strange echo of his life months ago in Satius's war camp. Except here, he'd been given sturdy gloves, a nice pair of boots, and 3 solid meals a day. The only thing wrong with the situation, other than the fact that he and the others would soon be charging a fortified position, was that he had too much free time. The workers hauled stacks of wood from one part of the lumberyard to the next, and were occasionally assigned to saw or chop. But there wasn't enough to keep them busy. That was a very bad thing, as he'd learned on the Shattered Plains. Give condemned men too much time, and they'd start to ask questions. Look, Penn said, walking next to Saw just ahead. At least tell me you're angry, Saw. Don't tell me you think we deserve this. We harbored a spy, Saw muttered. A spy that Moash had quickly learned had been none other than Kaladin Stormblessed. Like a bunch of slaves should be able to spot a spy, Hen said.
Really? Shouldn't the Spren have been the one to spot him? It's like they wanted something to pin on us. Like it's a
setup? Moash asked from behind.
Yeah, a setup,
Hen agreed. They did that a lot, forgetting words. Or maybe they were simply trying the words out for the first time. Their accent was so similar to that of many of the bridgemen who had been Moash's friends.
Let go, Moash, something deep within him whispered. Give up your pain. It's all right. You did what was natural. You can't be blamed. Stop carrying that burden. Let go.
They each picked up another bundle and began walking back. They passed the carpenters who were making the ladder poles. Most of these were parshmen, and one of the fused walked among their ranks. He was a head taller than the parshmen, and was a subspecies that grew large proportions of carapace armor in wicked shapes. The fused stopped, then explained something to one of the working parshmen. The fused made a fist, and dark violet energy surrounded his arm. Carapace grew there into the shape of a saw. The fused sawed, carefully explaining what he did. Moash had seen this before. Some of these monsters from the void were carpenters. Out beyond the lumberyards, parshmen troops practiced close-order drill and received basic weapon training. Word was that the army intended to assault Kolinar within weeks. That was ambitious, but they didn't have time for an extended siege. Kolinar had soulcasters to make food, while the Voidbringer operations in the country would take months to get going. This Voidbringer army would soon eat itself out of supplies and would have to divide up to forage. Better to attack, use overwhelming numbers, and seize the soulcasters for themselves. Every army needed someone to run at the front and soak up arrows. Well-organized or not, benevolent or not, the Voidbringers couldn't avoid that. Moash's group wouldn't be trained. They were really only waiting until the assault so they could run in front of more valuable troops.
We were set up, Hen repeated as they walked. They knew they had too few humans strong enough to run the first assault. They need some of us in there, so they found a reason to toss us out to die.
Saw grunted.
Is that all you're going to say? Hen demanded. Don't you care what our own gods are doing to us?
Saw slammed his bundle to the ground.
Yes, I care, Saw snapped. You think I haven't been asking the same questions? Storms, they took my daughter, Hen. They ripped her away from me and sent me off to die. Then what do we do?
Hen asked, her voice growing small.
What do we do?
Saw looked around at the army moving and churning, preparing for war. Overwhelming, enveloping, like its own kind of storm, in motion and inexorable. The sort of thing that picked you up and carried you along.
I don't know, Saw whispered. Storms, Hen. I don't know anything.
I do, Moash thought, but he couldn't find the will to say anything to them. Instead, he found himself annoyed, anger spren boiling up around him. He felt frustrated both at himself and at the Voidbringers. He slammed his bundle down, but then stalked off, out of the lumberyard. An overseer yelped loudly and scuttled after him, but she didn't stop him, and neither did the guards he passed. He had a reputation. Moash strode through the city, tailed by the overseer, searching for one of the flying type of fused. They seemed to be in charge, even of the other fused. He couldn't find one, so he settled for approaching one of the other subspecies. A Malin that sat near the city's cistern, where rainwater collected. The creature was of the heavily armored type, with no hair, the carapace encroaching across his cheeks. Moash strode right up to the creature.
I need to talk to someone in charge.
Behind him, Moash's overseer gasped, perhaps only now realizing that whatever it was Moash was up to, it could get her in serious trouble. The fused regarded him and grinned.
Someone in charge, Moash repeated.
The Voidbringer laughed, then fell backward into the water of the cistern, where he floated, staring at the sky. Great, Moash thought. One of the crazy ones. There were many of those. Moash stalked away, but didn't get much farther into the town before something dropped from the sky. Cloth fluttered in the air, and in the middle of it floated a creature with skin that matched the black and red clothing. He couldn't tell if it was Malin or Femalin.
Little human, the creature said with a foreign accent. You are passionate and interesting.
Moash licked his lips. I need to talk to someone in charge.
You need nothing but what we give you, the fused said. But your desire is to be granted. Lady Leshwe will see you.
Great. Where can I find her? The fused pressed its hand against his chest and smiled. Dark void light spread from its hand across Moash's body. Both of them rose into the air. Panicking, Moash clutched at the fused. Could he get the creature into a chokehold? Then what? If he killed it up here, he'd drop to his own death. They rose until the town looked like a tiny model. Lumberyard and parade ground on one side, the single prominent street down the center. To the right, the man-made ward provided a buffer against the high storms, creating a shelter for trees and the city lord's mansion. They ascended even farther, the fused loose clothes fluttering. Though the air was warm at ground level, up here it was quite chilly, and Moash's ears felt odd, dull, as if they were stuffed with cloth. Finally, the fused slowed them to a hovering stop. Though Moash tried to hold on, the fused shoved him to the side, then zoomed away in a flaring roil of cloth. Moash drifted alone above the expansive landscape. His heart thundered, and he regarded that drop, realizing something. He did not want to die. He forced himself to twist and look about him. He felt a surge of hope as he found he was drifting toward another fused. A woman, who hovered in the sky, wearing robes that must have extended a good 10 feet below her, like a smear of red paint. Moash drifted right up beside her.